How long have you been back in town?
It's been almost a year.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been almost a year now. I came back. I spent most of last winter in Minneapolis.
I remember that because I was following your progress. You've been going to a bunch of spots, mostly from city to city.
Yeah, I was. I started out. I was living in Chicago for like a little over a month.
Okay.
It was like, my friend called me up, and I was at a point in my life where I had left the office thing, the office work life, and I was just kind of bouncing around, and I didn't know what the hell to do, and I wanted to go on tour, and you know, my friend called me up, and he's like, hey, do you know anybody, that's looking for a place in Chicago? And I was like, I'll go. So I was living in New York at the time, and I said, yeah, my lease was up, and I was like, all right. So I went out there for a month, and then I started, just until it got warm enough to start touring.
Okay.
And I went out in the end of late March, and it was, I went through Milwaukee and Madison. When I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it was some of the coldest days of the year. Literally, it was like 10 degrees. I think it gets cold. It gets a little colder than that over there, I think. It definitely gets colder than that in Minnesota. But it was, when I was going with the folding bike, just going from city to city, and it was so unbearably cold some days that I got the impression in Milwaukee that like nobody really goes outside. But that's probably not the case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of the case in a lot of cities. In Portland, we have a pretty temperate winter, and it's usually like when it does snow, people freak out. They cancel school like for an inch of snow or less.
Yeah, I kind of want that sometimes, but then I kind of appreciate that we have a pretty mild winter compared to a lot of places.
Yeah, yeah. But like we were just talking about when I showed up, I think it's the idea that you really can't bicycle in the snow or the ice, and so that affects like how many people bike, how many people use bike share, how full the buses are.
Yeah, I mean, I bike all year round, but I don't bike as much, and I don't bike as far in the winter. And, around here, it's like you don't really need to do a whole lot. You really need to worry about clothing.
Right.
But in terms of the bike, it's just there's not a whole lot you have to do. When I was in Minnesota, you have to deal with roads that have, like, packed down snow and ice, for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
Because when it gets that cold, when it's below, like, 10 degrees Fahrenheit, the salt doesn't really do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't melt anything. So
there's all this snow, all this salt.
Yeah, you just have this snow and ice, and it's like, because it's like the cars have driven on it, it's like bumpy, and there's somebody wrote, I think it was, I think somebody put this on, maybe on streets.mn, which is a great transportation website.
Should I be following them?
You should.
Okay.
You should check it out. And then a while back there was a post of the different types of snow. And there was like the they had all these creative names for it, but there was like the what car tires have driven in, and then it freezes, so then you get these ruts,
like the permit track.
Yeah, and you just can't bike on that.
Yeah,
and so there's just like all the different names for all the awful stuff you see in the winter. And over there, I had gut studded tires, which really helped with the ice.
I was going to ask about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have them currently?
No. Well, I still have one just because I had it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put it on this year, I don't think. Especially because we haven't really had any snow yet.
It seems, yeah. I mean, it was supposed to rain today, and it was just a light sprinkle.
Yeah.
Just enough to dust my glasses, and that was all.
Oh, I'm glad.
So, yeah, I'm wearing wool. I've got my rain jackets in my backpack, but it's not a big need right now.
Yeah, and apparently you have bike issues, so we need to work on that.
As in, I don't have a bike that I can ride right now. That's the Raleigh Sprite, which it's a great frame. That's the only reason I haven't gotten rid of it. But, like, everything is broken on it, basically. Mm-hmm. I bought it from a shady guy down in Dorchester back in, I want to say it was 2010.
Huh.
And I had spent all week, we were here for a week, I was trying to get the bike, and just looking at options, trying to figure it out. It was going to be used because I couldn't afford a new bike. So I was like, anything that was around $100 on Craigslist. And there was a really good option that I passed up that I probably shouldn't have. And then there was this guy who, like, it seemed like it was kind of a half-assed chop shop. Like, he wasn't really chopping bikes, like, actively. He was just selling bikes to people who wanted bikes, I think. And if I hadn't taken the bus and the T for, like, I think it was like a two-hour ride to get there or something from where I was. Like, it was such an investment of time that I was deceived by the illusion of a sunk investment. I probably shouldn't have spent $100, and yet I did. And now I've spent like $200 to keep that $100 floating and running for the past 5 years.
Because so. I was going to say $100 for a bike really isn't bad.
But. It's not bad, but you get what you pay for, really. I mean, the frame is probably worth about that much. And that's really the only part that's left on it that's really good.
So I actually found the bike last week. I was biking along the Charles River.
You talking about this one in your basement?
Yeah, this one is in my basement now. I was telling you about it. It's, I found this... Just biking home, and I just saw it. It was like leaning up against a tree on a bike path by the river.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is weird. And I was like, I wonder if there was nobody around. Uh-huh. It was pretty cold. And I started looking at the bike, and I see, okay, the tires are flat, the chain's rusted. And I'm like, this is weird. It kind of looks like it was stolen, and then something happened, so the person just left it.
Abandoned.
Yeah. So, I mean, the best I could do was just, like, I checked with the police and, like, see if anybody had registered it. And, like, I tried posting it on Craigslist, but, like, and I got a few emails on that post, but they all had the wrong, yeah, different bike.
Okay.
So, I was like, I don't know. Although maybe I should offer it to one of those people.
Right. Well, you did lose a bike. Here's one that no one else seems to know about.
It's way too big for me. I tried to ride it, but I was able to ride at home. I was, you know, I was riding my own bike, so I because of my experience moving bikes for bike share systems, I'm able to ride two bikes at once.
Is this the standard ghost riding method of
yes.
just kind of you're on one and then you're holding the other handlebar and
yes.
Okay.
I don't know how common this is, but I know I've seen people done it at times, and I've like sort of like block traffic for them so they don't have to stop and wait for a left turn or something.
Right. The physics, especially like what the object in motion stays in motion. That's
it's just getting going. And you know, normally the real method of doing this is you're supposed to have your hand on the, or at least what I like to do, I like to ride the one on the left side, and then this way I can have access to both front brakes.
There you go.
Of course, this one I was riding, the front wheel was messed up. So I had to unclasp the V brake on there, so I didn't have a front brake.
You have no brakes on the second bike.
So here I am riding along at like 6 miles an hour. And I had to go across this highway section. I was just like, oh, please don't kill me.
I think I did that once with a free bike that I found. And I, you know, now that I say it, it sounds like legendary, laughable, and probably not a thing that would happen. But I was in Portland and there was a free bike. And it was a shitty bike. It was, I believe it was a Free Spirit. And I thought, like, oh, I'll fix this up and have it as a loaner or something. I think I ended up giving it away to some guy who didn't have a bike and probably should have kept it because I'm not sure he was a competent repairman, but so it goes.
Yeah, it's... oh, well. But, you guys were talking about Bromptons recently, and I know...
Yeah, Aaron took his on the plane. Yeah.
He said that he had some issues.
Right. Well, and
sounds familiar.
Yeah. So, what have your issues been? Have you had people that put up a stink?
Yeah, I've had. I would guess I would put it in two categories. One is people who don't want the bike being brought in stores or whatever mainly because they're worried that other people are gonna see that and they're gonna think, oh, I can bring my bike in here.
Bikes all over the store,
right?
And people doing wheelies in the aisles.
Yeah, and I think maybe those same people sort of also fear that, oh, like now people can't, you know, we put up enough of a fight to keep people from bringing their bikes inside buses and things, then, you know, because they're always in the way, and like, well, now people are gonna just get these and bring these, and that's, you know, then the transit agency is gonna say that's okay, and that's gonna be a problem. And so it's mainly been stores, and I've also had the you're traveling by bus and plane or whatever, then that category is how can we make a little more money off of this
thing? Right, right. Yeah, and in general, it seems like that's like if the magic word is bicycle at the airlines.
Yeah.
I've never taken my bike anywhere by plane, and I feel like it would be worth it to see something cool, especially like Hawaii, for example. I would love to go to Hawaii. I would love to bicycle around Hawaii, and I'd love to do it on my own bike if I could.
Yeah.
But it's like... I don't know.
Well, it's a lot easier for you to get to Hawaii than for me to get to Hawaii. So
it's true. I'm a little bit closer.
You need to go.
Well, we had looked into it. I think Adele and I have thought several times, like, oh, this would be a lot of fun. But it's the prohibitive cost. Either trying to find a bike that's suitable for bike touring, you know, so we could go out and ride around and camp. That would be expensive to rent, or it would be expensive to pack ours up and ship them. But... Yeah. I guess, I don't know, it probably depends on a lot of factors, so.
When I bought the folding bike, I calculated out that No, I spent, you know, Brompton is a lot more expensive than a lot of other folding bikes. Mm-hmm. I had more money at the time. Had I been in my current situation, I wouldn't have gotten a Brompton. But that being said, I remember calculating it and figuring out that the number of weekend trips, because I used to go down to New York a lot.
Yeah.
And that was one of the driving factors for getting it. I would bike to work when I worked went to work in rush hour in Boston. I would bike to work often, like 5 miles, but it wasn't, you know, I could just bike the whole way. Like, it wasn't like I really needed to take the train.
Yeah.
And if for whatever reason I needed to take the train home or something, I could just wait, you know, or I could just leave my bike at work. Like, I had parking in the office. So it wasn't like I needed it for work. It was mainly to take on a bus, like on Greyhound bus or something.
Right, right.
When I would go to New York, that would be the most common use. And to rent a bike in New York is just insane. There's it's like 40, 45 bucks a day, and there's because of the Central Park like tourism thing, there's just all these really shady shops like renting bikes. So yeah, when you rent a bike in New York, it's just a very awful experience. And
is that before or after the City Bike Share thing?
So this is probably, I'm thinking before.
Okay. But, so right. Back then, like, just right. Shady shops were your only choice.
That's right. So now you could ride city bikes.
Okay.
This would be different.
Would that also be prohibitively expensive? I mean, if you wanted to keep one all day.
So we talked about this recently. I've been working for, I work for Hubway in Boston. And
you do?
I do.
Okay.
Yes.
There we go. You were talking shop like a citizen.
Yes.
Just a minute ago.
So we talked about this once, and we figured that, and I know the price structure is a little different,
yeah,
but it's the same basic model, and we figured that for a couple hours, it's really not bad. Like, they don't want you to, you know, when we tell people the price structure and then it goes up, you know, we make it clear that we don't want people to take it for the whole day.
This is not supposed to be a daily rental.
But if you want to take it, and generally we don't expect you to take it more than an hour.
Yeah.
But we were thinking about the price structure, and that if you rent it for a couple hours at a time, or even if you think of it as a day rental, like, if you were going to rent a bike for the day, how much riding would you actually be doing? So say if you go to, you know, some other city, I don't know, say I go to Portland and I rent a bike, and, you know, maybe I'll ride for a couple hours, I might park it, I might, you know, do something else, and I'll ride a little bit later, you know. So when you think about the actual riding time and the fact that, you know, you only get charged for these big blocks of time, you know, 25-30 bucks really isn't bad for
right.
a bike that you can rent, that, you know, you just have to walk up to it, it's all over the city, you can put it wherever you want, you don't have to worry about locking it, all this stuff, it's, and it fits you, you know.
Yeah. So you're assuming that if it is a bike share that you're going to be using it to get from point to point in the city, and you're not going to be riding it all day, so it doesn't make sense to rent it all day. You're just going to take it one part of town to another, drop it off, and then, I don't know, go out to lunch or something, and then pick it up later.
Yeah. I wish it was just easier to actually rent the bike, because it's, you know, if you sign up for like a monthly or an annual membership, you get a special key that you can just put in the dock and you get your bike out. But
right.
if not, if you're just, you know, a one-time user, then you just have to not only have to walk up and put the credit card in, but you have to answer all these questions. And it's just like a big, it takes like 10 minutes and you're just like, why? You're like, this
yeah.
is supposed to save me time. And
right.
I just walked.
It's a time saver if you use it on the regular. It's not a time saver if you're going to be just like a one-time sort of rental. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's maybe similar to car sharing. I was thinking about Car2Go, because that's not here yet, right? But maybe, might be.
Somewhere. No, I don't think it's here yet.
Okay.
I feel like I would know this if it were.
Yeah.
I tried to use it in Minneapolis. I had a very unfortunate Car2Go experience.
Oh, yeah?
This was on my... I had joined a while back, and this was on my last day in Minneapolis when I was moving out. It was very cold,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, these are all like little electric cars.
Yeah.
Right?
Was yours electric, or was it like a small gas?
Actually, you're right. I don't know if it was all electric, but I know it was at least a hybrid.
Okay.
Maybe all electric. But I just remember, I found the nearest car. It was a few blocks away. I walked down there. I was going to go. I had a few things I had shipped everything, and I was just going to take a Greyhound bus to Chicago. It was
like
12 o'clock in the morning was the bus. So I was gonna take the regular bus. I just missed the regular bus, and it doesn't run very often at that hour. And I was like, all right, you know what? I'll just get a cab. And then I was like, well, I wonder, I could try that Car2Go. I can park it, you know,
why not?
Park it somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
So I walked down a few blocks, and you know, I tried to get in the car, and just the key's not working. The card is just not working. Finally, you know, I called him. troubleshooting, and they find, you know, we finally get the car open, and then I get in and it won't start.
So it's like a dead battery or something. Battery. Oh, okay.
And then so after all that, we so he's trying to, you know, tell me all these times. I'm like, look, thing won't start. Just give me another car, you know. So I go to, we go to, yeah. So I go to another car, which is like 5 blocks away.
Yeah.
At that point, I already spent like 20 minutes in this.
Right.
Could have, you know, walked halfway to downtown.
There's your suck investment. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I, and then second car, you know, battery wouldn't start, and I wound up missing the bus because at that point it was just like, and it was like, okay, if I call a cab,
it's missing
like,
the Greyhound.
It's like, I'm just not going to have time to get over there.
Yeah. So did you, does that mean you had to, like, did you have to pick up a, another bus ticket, or were you
so able
to
refund your ticket? Or? Yeah, I had to buy another ticket.
Okay.
Because, of course, I had a refundable ticket.
And, oh, there we go.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, non-refundable ticket.
Oh, okay. So you had to buy a new one.
Yes. I had to buy a new ticket. So I had to go back, and I lived with awful roommates. So I was like, I had to go back. Be like, I'm staying tonight, guys.
After you had said, like, peace out, bitches.
Yeah, pretty much.
Never seeing you again.
Yeah, so I wound up just crashing on the couch for that night.
Oh, man. Then, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And then I took a bus at, like, 7 in the morning.
Right, right. So Car2Go is responsible for your worst night ever.
Well, so I don't know if they're responsible for it. I mean, the vehicle type that they use, I think, is especially prone to this. It was like 0 degrees.
So, yeah, cold weather, batteries, losing charge or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
was it pretty new? Like, had the system just arrived or?
Yeah, but in the past 6 months.
Okay. But so it was like their first winter.
Right. Oh, so the other thing, right. So I had the key. This is the other thing. I had a key for the vehicle because I couldn't lock. I think it was the second vehicle.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't. That's why I spent so much time with the first vehicle, because I couldn't lock the, it wouldn't let me like lock the car for some reason. So I had, because the battery didn't work, so I couldn't scan
car
and lock it.
Oh.
Right? So I had the key.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so if the battery's dead, then that's like everything's dead.
Yeah. And they wouldn't want to let me leave the key somewhere.
Right.
So I had to, like, the next day when I was taking the bus, I had to, like, meet up with the guy. I had to, like, call
find
them
somewhere.
Yeah, and he had to, like, come to the bus terminal and meet me. And he's like, yeah, I've been just going around just chasing dead batteries all day.
Oh, man, that's rough. And that's why the bicycle is still a simpler solution.
Yes.
Your own private, personally owned bicycle.
Yes, because the bike share has issues with the batteries as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have, there's those stations run on solar power with battery. You know, they have these two big car batteries in there, 60 pounds each.
Okay.
And so,
they're not connected to the grid. They're independent.
Right, right. Although there's been some talk about connecting them to the grid in a place like New York, Chicago, where they go in year round.
Like as a backup or something.
Exactly.
Or just as primary because they're always in use.
Well, some of the stations that, when I did this in Minnesota as well, and some of the stations are just located in places where there's just not a lot of direct sunlight.
Where the sun doesn't shine.
Yes.
Yeah.
We had a few of those, especially with the downtown buildings. There were a few of those.
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, we just didn't get a lot of sun, and so we just could change batteries all the time.
Totally. You know, I never considered that, but solar power, like in Chicago, for example, downtown Chicago, the buildings are huge. So, yeah, there's very, like, you get like an hour's window where there's direct sunlight or something if you're on the right street. That's fascinating. So you were working with BikeShare in Minneapolis, and was that was the first time?
That was the first time. Yes.
Yeah.
That was basically I had done a tour and then I just kind of was kind of bumming around.
Like I need a job
out.
Now.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out like if I wanted to stay there, and I sort of spent a month. I went back there for the Brompton. What's it called? The
championships?
Brompton U.S. Championship, yes. Yeah. That was a fun event. If you have not heard of this, you should go look up pictures online.
So our listeners, Orange and Purple, down in Santa Monica, I think were there.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember. It was last year, the year before. Yeah, I feel like it was when you were there. Yes. But yeah, I believe they took some sort of awards for that.
There was somebody there that was wearing like all purple.
Okay.
An award for the best dressed.
Nice. Was there someone wearing all orange?
I can't remember what her name is, but I don't remember an orange person.
Yeah, Cynthia, I believe.
Yes, Cynthia. That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hi, Cynthia.
Yeah. I love the idea of the challenge is that you have to be wearing a tie, right? A tie and a jacket.
That's right. You had to wear a tie. Yeah, you had to wear a jacket and tie. You didn't have to wear
any pants.
Because
it's British.
Right. You didn't have to wear any pants, but you had to wear like.
Right.
You know, you had to wear a jacket and tie.
Trousers, however.
Right.
A necessity.
Right. So I remember wearing like jean shorts and a suit jacket. I'm not a fast rider, and so like obviously I wasn't gonna win it. But I remember going, I was about two laps in. You basically just it's a 1 mile, well, it's a half mile section of street.
Okay.
And
just like around like a grid.
Yeah. You just go up, you go up like, so what it was essentially, half mile. And then you make a big U-turn in the middle. It's like a 4-lane street.
Yeah.
So you just make it with a median in the middle. So you make a big U-turn, and then you go down to the other end. You make a big U-turn. And you do that 6 times.
Oh, so it's not even a circuit. It's just like like a back and forth, up and down the main drag.
This is what it was in Minneapolis. We did it. It was on Lindale Avenue South and 31st to 35th Street.
There we go.
Yeah, so you just go up and down, and I think maybe the second lap, somebody was like, your light's on, my dynamo light was on.
Dude, that's the greatest thing about dynamo. I feel like I have to answer that, or I have to respond to that more times, and it, like, I'll be locking up my bike, walking away, some guy's like, your light's on. And I'm trying to figure out, because like, at some point you get tired of the question, and you don't want to be an asshole, you want to be like, yes, it is, thank you.
But I tell people, oh, it's automatic. But
it goes off on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's hard for me to like hold back the, you know, because it's like so many times, do I have to keep answering the question or keep responding like, no, it's okay, it's not a big deal.
It's kind of like when you're riding your bike in the winter, you get a lot of people and it's like,
yeah,
wow, is that your primary mode of transportation? Or like, wow, you ride all year. It's like,
yeah.
It's like, dude, this is Boston. There's bicycles.
Right. I had a lady at my workplace, and admittedly, I work with old people who aren't used to bikes as a regular mode of transportation, and I work a long ways away from most places where people bike. Mm-hmm. And there was a lady who was like bordering on angry at the fact that I was out in the cold. She's like, "You're gonna freeze yourself. Why don't you drive your car?" And I had to say, I don't have a car. And I thought it was fairly evident. I've worked there for like almost 8 years now and never had a car, I think, since I started the job. And there are still people who have been there that entire time that don't realize that I'm a carless person. So it goes.
Some people just, I don't think they get it. They have this image in their head of like, you know, the probably the worst possible image that you could have of what they think of as a quote unquote poor person.
The film industry's bicycling person.
Right, yes.
Have you noticed this in like, you know, well, it was the 40-year-old virgin, I think, was a prime example of this, where Steve Carell's character, he wobbles to work on a bike because that's all he's got, and mm-hmm. he's a loser,
yeah,
and also a virgin. So there's, what's the, I feel like there was another one where the bicycle, it was just recently, we talked about it, the No Good, Terrible, Very Bad Day, where the lady like needs to get somewhere quick and the only option is a bike, and then she shows up and she has messy hair for the rest of time, you know, because she rode a bike. So yeah,
is that because she wore a helmet?
Yes, it is.
There you go. Yeah, that's a small solved right there.
It's a sub argument. But it's a funny deal.
Yeah.
So remind me, how long did you work for the bike share in Minneapolis?
About a year. Well, it was one season.
Okay.
It was most of one season.
Yeah, from the rollout until they packed everything.
Yeah, well, I got there in the summer, so it was, and it wasn't there for the rollout, but I was there for the pack up, takedown.
Yeah.
We sadly removed all the bikes from the stations, and
it's the worst time of year.
Yes, all the stations from the street. I think there were a couple of stations that got stored in place. They just got covered, and you know, just like the bikes were taken out, and the stations were just covered, and I think
gotcha.
They took the terminal out, but. For the most part, all these stations, you know, they came in with a construction team with a crane,
uh-huh.
and they, you know, lift it up, and I'm sure there's pictures online of this, and we've been doing a lot of the same here for Hubway. I haven't been involved with the so-called demolition team.
Is that what they call it?
That's what they were calling it over here.
That's
I think.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We're going to demolish the bike share.
Yeah. There's been some talk about Boston going year round. Cambridge, this is the second year going year round.
Okay.
So there's been some talk about Boston going year-round, but it doesn't seem like it's happening for this year.
One step at a time.
It's a shame because I'm moving in a week, and my new place is going to be walking distance from a Hubway station.
It'd be very useful, right?
Yeah, and right now I'm 2 miles from the nearest Hubway station. So
that's a long ways.
I suppose if I were desperate at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I could ride into Harvard Square and then just walk in. It's like I've walked that before a few times. I walked it one time when the buses were so badly bunched up that I waited and waited and waited, and I was like, fuck it, I'm going to walk.
Yeah.
And then I got just as I was getting like a block from Harvard Square, the bus came by. And I was like, all right, well, I didn't save any money because I got a monthly pass, but I got a little exercise here and I walk about 40 minutes.
What would you say your usual mode split is these days? Like, are you primarily bicycle? Or are you like half and half bikes and transit? Or
I've been thinking about that because...
I don't think I could answer that question if it was posed to me, so I don't know if that's a fair question to you.
I mean, it varies by time of year. I would say on average it's probably half and half.
Okay.
Half bike, half transit. Right now I can't really walk to anything from my house. I mean, there's a few things I can walk to, but...
Like, it's not practical for you to walk there.
Yeah, right. Most of the stuff that I need is, like, I just... It's not within walking distance, but... I suppose if I were going on a transit journey, I suppose, like, the transit journey would be my activity.
Right.
And therefore, I'd be walking to it.
It's not your actual mode.
But, seriously, I like to walk more, and to my new place, I'll be walking more, but it's typically, about half bike, half transit. In the summer, it can get up to probably 80% bike, maybe... and I almost always bike to work in the summer. The winter can be a little bit less than half. Just depends on the weather. You know, if it's like a big snowstorm, I'm going to take the bus.
Right.
If it's super cold, I'm going to take the bus. But if it's not too bad, and also it depends where I'm going. You know, mm-hmm. if I'm going in a place that's easy to get to by bus, then great. But if I'm doing something that takes like an hour by transit and 20 minutes by bike, then I'm probably still going to bike.
That's the easy choice. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm a practical transportation user, I guess.
Right, right. You do what makes the most sense at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I stopped getting my pass this last year. I used to have a transit pass that I got super cheap because I'm kind of in the transportation industry, driving school bus. Mm-hmm. But I used to get a cheap pass for all year. And then they took that away this year because of low usership. So... I found that I'm actually probably not going to spend that much more, like just buying regularly priced fares. I'm probably not going to spend that much more in a year riding the bus because I don't take it that much. Mm-hmm. And when I had the pass, I used to take it all the time. But
so you're saying it's basically you're going to ride your bike more because
yeah, I already have cost. Been. Yeah.
So we were talking about this recently with a friend about we were talking about car sharing, right? Mm-hmm. And saying about Zipcar,
yeah.
in particular, and thinking about how when you have your own car, it's like, or I guess your own bicycle, you could say, it's like you, or a monthly pass is related. It's like when you have your own vehicle, all the costs are sunk. So you're not, it doesn't cost you anything. There's no marginal cost to like go out, mm-hmm. right? Whereas with, you know, once you have like a Zipcar, right? It's like you have to pay.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're not paying as much. So it's cheaper. But like every time you want to go out, you have to pay for it. And so you right. got to think like, you know, do I really want to do this or can I just take the bus?
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of a parallel for the bus because it's like if you have your monthly pass, then it's very easy to make trips. It's easy to, you know, the example I like to give is if you're making a transfer from one subway to another or something, you could, you know, if you want to come up and, you know, get a drink or use the bathroom or whatever, you know,
right.
you can totally do that and because it's free and you don't really think about these things. You can make, there's a lot of journeys in Boston where because of the way the system is set up and we don't have a grid system, it's, often you might need more than two vehicles and you only get two vehicles included in your fare. It's like a one free transfer.
Oh, right.
So you might need more than two. So, well, you get a monthly pass, you know, big deal, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. If you don't, then, you know, you sort of wind up taking these really long, circuitous journeys because you don't want to pay that extra.
Yeah, totally.
You know? And there's some people that just, you know, don't want to pay. And there's some mm-hmm. people who, you know, really can't pay. And then there's like a lot of us in the middle, I think. There's also with the cars, it's if you have your own car, it's very easy to drive it places to like go do food shopping or whatever. And when we talk about transit fares, we say, well, okay, I want to go down and do something basic. I want to do food shopping. I got to go to work. I got to go, you know, pick up something for my kids, whatever. Bus fare is now $1.60. So, okay, there's $3.20 that it costs me to, if I have to take a subway, well, that's $4 that it costs me to just to go out and buy groceries, right. for example.
That's not bad, though. I mean, bus fare, $1.60?
$1.60.
Okay, because it's $2.50 now in Portland, like across the board.
Oh, really? Okay.
Regardless of mode.
It's $2 for the subway here. Portland has something I really like, and Minneapolis has this, and I think San Francisco has a version of it. It's where instead of paying your fare and then getting one free transfer, you just get you talked about this in the last show, I think. You get 2 hours or 2.5 hours. It just went up to 2.5 hours.
Two and a half hours. So it's $1 an hour.
Right. So you can, and I think that's really something that would be great for Boston. It was and many places is that you just when you pay one fare, you get to keep using that same fare for 2.5 hours. And
yeah.
I think that's it's really nice for, especially if you want to make quick trips and get back, but also if you have to do these multi-trip journeys. If you have to take, a lot of times here, you might have to take a bus to the subway and then another bus and then maybe even another bus after that. You know, it just makes sense that it should be, you know, why are we charging these extra fares?
Right, right. Yeah, and if you have the, well, here in Boston, it's the Charlie card, and Portland is going to get some sort of electronic payment system pretty soon, which will do some of the math for you, which works out okay. It's weird in Portland because the $250, I guess, for your first ticket, if you have to ride the bus again outside that 2.5 transfer time, it's the cost of a day pass, so... If I take the bus one way, I usually know that I'm going to have to take it the other way, which means that I just buy a day pass kind of de facto.
Uh-huh.
But it's nice that like that math could be done for you in TriMet's hypothetical system that someday will be a reality.
Yeah, well, Minneapolis has that. They have their go-to card,
okay,
which is just the Charlie card. This is the smart card.
Yeah.
And yeah, you just tap it, and you can also if you pay cash, they'll give you a paper transfer.
Okay.
That, you know, you can use in any other buses or light rail.
That's your day pass.
Their fare is a little less. It's $1.75 off peak and $2.25 in the peak period. They actually charge a little more in the peak period. And actually, it's even more for express buses. You would take the express bus from, say, Minneapolis to St. Paul. I think it's $2.25 and $3.
It's not too bad.
No, I mean, for what it is, given that the fact that transit fares are riding up, I mean, I believe that there should be free transit. We should have free transit.
It'd be great. I mean, people would use it if that was the case.
Yeah, I think that that's part of what it is, and I need to make. I've been thinking about making a YouTube video on this, and just trying to, you know, just make the case for free transit. And a lot of the objections, I think, are things that can easily be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the objections being, oh, there's going to be so many people riding, and then how are we going to deal with that? And it's like, well, more buses.
that's not necessarily a problem,
right? So,
well, it'd be so great because then that would reduce traffic. No matter how many buses you put on the road, it seems like if people are taking the bus instead of driving, traffic will be better.
Oh yeah,
it's funny. I mean, do you think has traffic gotten worse here in the past, say, 10 years?
It's really hard to say. I mean, I haven't noticed it personally, but I haven't noticed a change. I don't know. A lot of people. So statistically, driving is down.
Yeah.
Like we know, and we especially here, we know that vehicle miles traveled is down. There are fewer cars on the road. Like every street that's measured, you know, they measure the number of cars per day.
Yeah.
Pretty much has gone down.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes, and the number of people living in the city has gone way up.
Mm-hmm.
So much that we have a huge housing crisis right now, and you know, and gentrification happening everywhere. It's kind of a mess. And the number of people riding transit is at an all-time high. The number of people biking is at an all-time high. So we still have, you know, we still deal with all these road projects where the highway engineers, they're still planning for a 1% increase every year.
Okay.
In traffic.
So they're building counts up and building out, getting right, bigger.
Even though we know that the counts are going down.
Mm-hmm. Building a bigger fish tank for a bigger fish to grow into.
Right. And I haven't personally noticed it, but I've also, my attitude and behavior has sort of changed as I've gotten older, I suppose. When I first learned to bike, I was 22. And it was very much like, I very much got into the, you know, dealing with traffic, and I was like in there, I wanted to go fast, and I was like, you know, go in and out of traffic and stuff, and I was very sort of, you know, what you might think of as like, I rode the kind of like a messenger.
Okay.
that stereotype, right? And over time I've sort of become much more conservative, and I, you know, things that I used to do back then, I would think, oh, you got to be out of your mind to ride on that road,
right,
or whatever. And you know, I'll do things like, I'll go up on the right side and I'll just, like, you know, wait for a gap, and then I'll, you know, go across, make my left turn or something, you know. I'll do stuff like that, and I'm very conscious of like the door zone and, you know, not getting right hooked and that sort of thing. I'll take the lane and stuff. So, sort of my style has changed, but I still get really angry with cars. I still have a really hard time.
So would you say you're taking more risks than you used to, but they're more calculated?
I would say I take fewer risks, but...
Oh, okay.
But the risks that I do take are like... The things that might seem like risks are like... I know a lot more about bike safety.
Okay.
Right. So I know about, like, a lot of times people think like, oh, this guy's, you know, riding in the middle of the road, he's going to get himself killed. And it's like, well, no, that's actually safer. So you don't get right hooked.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, or Dord.
Or Dord, yes.
Yeah.
So I went to a public meeting recently, and it was this this corridor where the city on Commonwealth Avenue in Alston, where the city is proposing, is they're going to do a big reconstruction of the street, and they're proposing to put bike lanes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, the street already has bike lanes. They're already in the door. They're completely door zone bike lanes. They're proposing to do the same thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's 10 years ago, they put bike lanes on a different portion of Comm Ave, and that was like huge progress because those were the first bike lanes in the city.
Right, Commonwealth Avenue, which I remember last time I rode that had like bike boxes and stuff too, which is great.
Right.
It's people, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I think there was even a crossover, like a left-hand bike lane at yes. one part of that.
So that was the different portion of Comm Ave, right?
Yeah.
So it was, so that's in the Back Bay. And there's another portion, if you go west, where it's like really wide.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's three lanes in each direction. There's a tiny little bike lane, there's park lane, and there's the trolley in the middle, the B-lines, the light rail, which still stops at like every two blocks like it did in 1910, whatever that was. But so that's part of it, is, you know, trying to make the B-line a little faster. But
okay.
Yeah, so the city said, well, we'll put bike lanes back. And it's like, hey, you know, come on. Bike lanes are not good enough anymore. You know, now we're talking about protected bike lanes. We're talking about, you know, bike box. We're talking about bike signals. Mm-hmm. Talking about, you know, raised crosswalks. We're talking about all this traffic calming, all this stuff that's like, oh, you know, 10 years ago it wasn't.
Brand new street technology.
Right. And so I went to this public meeting, and I was just, it was mainly built as a, it was run by the student bike, BU Bikes from Boston University student group. And they were
my wife's alma mater.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so that's why, yeah. So she knows people in Boston, I guess.
Big fan of BU. Yeah.
Cool. So in BU Bikes, the main purpose of the meeting was to get people to come and speak out and share stories with city officials. And I was just shocked by the number of people who had said they had been doored.
Oh, really?
Some even multiple times.
So this is a big thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, you know it happens, but, like, have you ever been doored yourself?
Personally, I've never actually crashed into a door.
Okay. So and you're also conscious of the fact that it could happen. You're careful.
Yes. Yeah. I try to ride in a way that I won't get doored.
Yeah.
But, you know, that being said, like, there, sometimes I'll catch myself being a little too close, or, you know, you do things like, you know, if there's a bunch of stop traffic, you go through to get to the front. Well, any one of those cars, a person could just open it, especially a taxi.
Sure.
A person could just open the door and, oh, I'll get out here. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then boom.
Yeah.
There you go. And so.
And so at this meeting, like, a ton of people have gotten doored. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So it's a big problem. And drivers, have you ever gotten doored?
I don't think so, no.
Have you ever confronted anybody about, like, doing something reckless, like opening a door in front of you or something, cutting you off or whatever?
You know, right before I left town, I had an incident where someone passed me, like, a little bit too close with a really loud engine. And I think it was more my ego than, and I don't think I was in actual danger, but I was like, I'm going to follow these people and, like, give them the stink eye or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, like, I followed them until they parked, just because it was the route home. And then when I got there, I looked at them and I was like, I shouldn't make a stink. I'm just going to turn into a mean person. So I decided not to.
So you're trying to take the high road, and I tried to. I have sort of mixed feelings about this, you know.
But I took the low road until there was no choice but to take the high road, or be a bad person.
I mean, the thing is, like, if you ever try to, in my experience, yell at somebody, or even, like, just try to say, hey, you know, that was just kind of try to watch, you know, it's dangerous, whatever, you know. The response is, like, always, it's always one of defensiveness, fuck you, you know, go fuck yourself, you should have been like over there, you know.
There's no good way to be friendly and confrontational.
Right, it's like, even if, no matter how friendly I might be, even though you just put my life in danger, it's like, they don't care.
Right.
So, the fact that, you know, if we keep, I guess we got to think different systems, or...
Like different communication systems?
Different road systems.
Road
systems. Like, we can't keep putting in these little bike lanes, like, painted bike lanes. They just don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And
to keep bad things from happening.
There's a bike lane in Jamaica Plain, like, near where I'm actually moving to, where on the main street, it's Center Street, it's like through a business district, typical Boston street,
okay.
Where it's like, you know, it's a pretty narrow street, I suppose. It's parking on both sides, and there's like one travel lane each way. And there's like, they striped a bike lane recently. It's like a 10, they made like a 10-foot travel lane, and it's like a 4 or 5 foot, the bare minimum bike lane.
Okay.
It's right next to the parked cars. And what they actually did in this is not too uncommon, but they actually did in this case is they put like little hash stripes to mark the door zone.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like as if like they painted these lines as if like a, you know, like on an angle. And it's, most of the bike lane is that stripe.
Okay. <They're> like, so you've got like 2 feet to bicycle in and 3 feet of danger zone.
Right, which is dangerous because when you're biking, you need like 4 feet or so to operate within because, you got to – naturally, physically, the bicycle doesn't go straight. It's just the way physics work, right?
Small corrections keeping you in balance.
Exactly. So – and then – you got to swerve around, potholes and debris and, things. So you just can't ride in 2 feet.
What's a pothole? I'm kidding. We just have so many new streets in Portland. We used to have a ton of them and like a lot of stuff's been repaved. And so like potholes are a very rare occurrence in the places where I am these days.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, see, there are places particularly in the southern U.S. where they don't get snow. They don't get big rainstorms. They don't have these freeze thaw cycles.
Oh, sure.
That the streets are just, they're concrete. They're all concrete, uh-huh. And they're just in great shape.
They're glorious because the ground has never changed underneath them.
And I was just amazed when I was riding in Dallas. I was like, this would be a wonderful place to bike.
Yeah.
If, like, the only thing that I needed were, like, nicely paved streets.
Right. If there was no cultural cachet.
Yeah, and, like, the fact that all their streets were, like, 4 lanes wide. And yeah. Everything, it's just ridiculous.
It's funny. I met one of my wife's, shirt tail relatives. They came up for the Nike race in Portland. It was like the nationals for high school runners or something like that. But one of the guys that we met lives in Texas, huge bike fan, loves going biking, but he would never ride like for transportation or on like, city streets because it's completely dangerous.
Oh yeah. There's
and I wanted to ask like him, here. I wanted to ask him if it was like cultural reasons or if it just felt like physically unsafe.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of people like that here, and people talk about that they want a bike, and it goes back to that somebody did a study, essentially state the obvious a couple of years ago. They're like, these 60% of people, I forget what they call them.
Interested but concerned?
Yes, the interested but concerned, right? They came up with this study, and they're like, oh, people want a bike, but they don't feel safe. And you're like, no shit. But that's what it is people...
we've heard this.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. It's people just don't feel safe, and for very good reason.
Yeah.
I mean, you see the kind of shit that you have to deal with out there, and it's just people talk about biking is fun and it's great, and it's like all you need to have is like one of these experiences where somebody almost kills you and then just tells you to go fuck yourself and you're just like,
right,
I'm never doing this shit again.
You think this is a good idea?
Yeah,
this is terrible.
It's very difficult in the bike advocate standpoint because you're trying to you want to get more people biking, right?
Right.
Encourage people to bike, and it's very safe and all that, but at the same time it's like, well, you don't want to sort of ignore that reality. You want to teach people how to deal with some of this stuff. And, you don't want to ignore the fact that, people are getting killed on the streets.
Right. Yeah. And when that happens, that's a problem. Do you think that's well addressed here?
No, I don't think it's well acknowledged.
Okay.
I don't think I don't think it's high enough, the number of people being killed in the streets. I don't think it's high enough for people to really start in the cities, really start agitating on it. But on the other hand, it does happen, and there are a lot of people getting injured. And then there's one thing that often goes unrealized is because from the car driver's point of view, it's like, well, I didn't touch you. Everything's fine. They'll drive like a foot from you and they'll be like, oh, at like 30 miles an hour, like, oh, what do you want? I didn't hit you.
Psychological harm is no big deal.
And it's like the terror that you see on the streets.
Yeah.
You see people like standing in a crosswalk trying with their kids, trying to get across the street. And they're just like, these cars are just whizzing by and you're just, they're like trying to get a bus or whatever. And it's like, you just see that, or you'll be waiting across the street and the light turns red and all these cars are just going and they're beeping at you. And you're just like, I'm putting myself in danger here. I'm just trying to get around. Just trying to go buy my groceries or go to work or whatever.
Right.
And it's like, that it goes unrealized because there's no quantitative way that's been measured. And I just feel like it gets no attention.
So there needs to be a war on terror in the streets.
Yes. War on terror. that went pretty well last time. How'd that go?
Still wrapping up, man. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's a weird deal. And I guess the other thing, like I always talk to my my father-in-law about this because the traffic patterns and the way that people operate on the streets. Hey, Jake the cat.
Yeah, we have a cat here, by the way. Who's,
Jake is a really nice cat. The cultural patterns and cultural behaviors, like the technical way that you're supposed to operate, for example, like signals. And he always talks about left turns with auto drivers, like... technically, it's a yield, but also if someone's turning left, they will usually cut in front of you if they're the first person in line.
Right.
So it seems like...
Or if you're on a bike.
Or that, yeah. they will cut in front of you. It seems to me like there's more cultural leniency here. Like, people don't have to be as technically right because there's a cultural pattern of saying it's okay to not... It's okay to disregard these rules. And I feel like there's probably a certain amount of that wherever you go. But different cities, like certain places, like, for example, Boston here, it seems like that's... There's a very high cultural leniency because people are okay with a bit more fudging. Whereas in Portland, I think people get far more agitated when someone doesn't follow the law.
That's interesting. We're sort of used to it here, you know, people being jerks and
right.
You know, and I drive a truck for work too, so I see that as well.
Yeah.
And it was sort of for a little while. I drove a mail truck. You know, I delivered the mail for a little while. It's like a few months.
U.S. Postal Service.
Yes.
Nice. And, you wore the blues.
I did. Well, I just didn't have a uniform, but that's another story. but that was when I saw there was when you're driving the mail truck, you get a bit more respect than when you're driving
the mail vehicle. Must get through. Yeah,
you know, it's weird because it's like a lot of people. Yeah, there were plenty of people that were impatient, but they understood what the truck was doing.
Right.
You know, it's like if I'm driving the, you know, this Hubway van or whatever, it's like, you know, and I'll try to, you know, pull over to the station or I'm trying to make a U-turn or whatever. You know, there's always like, it's always very difficult. People get angry and they don't understand what's going on. And, you know, with the mail truck, it's like, okay, they understand. They're like, this is a thing that moves pretty slow and it stops frequently and it delivers the mail.
Yeah.
You know, somebody gets out of it and, you know, it's like, so that was sort of interesting. But I think part of it's that it's just understanding. And part of it's just like being very self-centered. We're all self-centered when we move around.
Yeah. And that's why cities are hard.
Right. And so we don't really give the benefit of the doubt to the other person.
Right, right.
You know, we think this person in front of us is not moving fast enough. Let's like, you know, honk at him and yell at him.
Totally.
It's like, okay, well, they don't see that there's an old guy with a cane walking across the street. It's like, well, yeah, okay, I have a green light, but like, I mean, should I hit him? Like, just wait a minute.
You want I should run this guy over? All right, then. Yeah. There was a thing that just happened in Portland. I think I read the press on it as I was coming over here, but we have a multi-use path, pedestrian bicycle path, and there was a guy out for like a training ride, kind of this like recyclist performance racer guy.
Your favorite.
Yes. And he was out for like a training ride, ended up passing a lady who was I think somewhat elderly. She was out for a walk. He yells something like, "On your left." She's, you know, confused, as people often are, about which direction she should move, so she moves to the left.
Oh.
He hits her doing something like 20 miles an hour. She was okay. She needed medical attention, but she swore she would never walk on the path again. And it's one of those things where, like, I read all the comments because it was a fascinating discussion. Yeah. But one guy was like, you know, if you're going to be training, train on the roads, because the roads are designed for people who are going, you know, 30, 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
If you're out for a pleasant ramble, you know, take the path, because the path is where everyone goes. But one of the things, like, kind of like the man you were talking, the hypothetical man with a cane walking across the street against the signal, one of the ideas was like, you should always be cautious on these multi-use paths, because you have no idea, like, for example, if the person is deaf and you say on your left and, you know, they don't move, you got to slow down, you got to be cautious, because you have no idea what this person's disability might be. It's just like the general slow down, take care of people, be nice to them. But it's really hard to do because most people don't give themselves enough time to travel. So
the don't be a jerk rule.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It's like you gotta watch out for other people, and you gotta just be nice and just not, you know, not do anything that puts anybody else in danger. And
right.
On a bike, you know, here we see it on this guy's going, you know, 20 miles an hour on his bike, which is, you know, it's not super fast. It's reasonably fast. I mean, it's fast for me.
Yeah.
But I mean, I ride a slow city bike. But you know, it's the idea that you're the car in that situation, right? I mean, you don't want cars to go, you know, recklessly driving around you and stuff, and then you go and you do it to people walking. I mean, that's just being a jerk.
Well, this is like the classic justice thing: is that the people with power have to be careful that they don't disadvantage the people with less power. Mm-hmm. I guess, like, if we're gonna draw broad principles.
Oh, because eventually they'll rise up.
Eventually, there will be a revolution of the proletariat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, revolution of the transit riding public.
One of the things, maybe I probably should wrap up and start moving. One of the last things I was curious about was, it's been, you might have told me the answer already, how long since you worked for the T?
It's been a couple of years at least.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like cube farmish, like you were in an office.
Just sort of, yeah. In the office world, I had my own office. I could close the door. You know, this very is a nice luxury in an office. I had no windows, but yeah, that's like the next level.
Only managers get windows.
Yeah, no, I went to a lot of meetings and stuff, but yeah, I was working in the office. That was one of the things that I didn't like about it. But
okay.
I love public transit, and I'm trying to figure out how to get back into it. But
right, so I was going to ask, like, do you miss it? If not, why? If so, why?
Well, I love working on public transit, and I love thinking about these things and, you know, trying to, I think one of my biggest frustrations there is that the, you know, a transit agencies in general, and especially these big old large ones, are just very, they're very conservative places. They're very, I don't want to say regressive, but they're just not, they're just sort of very much in the status quo, because there's so much risk in anything you can do.
Like every choice,
everything you can do will piss people off. Could cause unintended consequences. You know, you alter a route. You know, you alter a schedule by a few minutes, and all of a sudden now there's this. Now you hit the school time, or you know, now it's, you know, you all of a sudden they just random variables coexist in ways that you didn't imagine, and all of a sudden now you're having major problems. You know, and then not to mention the people who will complain.
Yeah.
It's sort of easier to do the status quo. And it's, and then you also get the case of an organization like the T, they're so understaffed that they're busy putting out fires every day.
Right.
And they don't have the time or even the energy when you're doing that to focus on okay, where can we look to make improvements?
So the innovation is too difficult.
Yeah, it's not that it can't happen. It's impossible or too difficult for a transit agency. But it's just that I know that T doesn't have the resources for that.
Yeah.
So I found myself as sort of like one of the few people that was trying to really push stuff, and I probably approach that kind of thing differently now that I have a little bit more experience. Uh-huh. And sort of, you know, I might latch on to a few things that I could do instead of just trying to, you know, do what I thought was no-brainers, which actually was very involved.
Right, right.
But yeah, and I love public transit, and I love, you know, thinking about it and designing it and working with people, working on the operations. I sort of see myself as like an operations manager in the future, maybe.
Okay, yeah. I think there was an opening in Portland for one at TriMet, so.
I wanted to ask you, can I ask you about Portland?
Yeah, go for it.
So I've still never been there, and I've been trying to get over there. It was my original plan when I was bike touring to make it out there, and then I ran out of money.
It's a long ways away.
But I hear about Portland a lot, right? And I sort of hear it in two camps. There's sort of like the bike community, which thinks it's like this, you know, nirvana. And then there's also like the vegan community that I am associated with that I hear about, like, you know, people think it's like, oh, great. And there's like, apparently there's this like group of restaurants that they call the mini mall, and they're all like right next to each other.
The vegan mini mall. It's true. It exists.
It exists.
We also have a vegan strip club. So
really,
if you're okay with a little bit of misogyny, there's also a place to cater for you in that regard.
I feel like intersectionality is a little missing over there.
I think you're probably right.
Okay. But I hear about Portland, you know, from these two spheres, and people make it sound like it's just paradise. And what I seem to think about, my suspicion is that Portland is just like your typical progressive city, like a Cambridge or Berkeley or Boulder, where it's like it's sort of people doing like more progressive things, but it doesn't seem like it's, I mean, you still have real life issues there. It's not like heaven.
Yeah. Well, case in point, some of the biggest radio stations are the ones that broadcast conservative talk radio programs.
Okay.
So, just like any other place, you know, you have a hotbed of liberalism surrounded by a nice bed of conservative thought as well. So, yeah, I mean, it there are points where you have, like, if you subscribe to a heavily left-leaning philosophy, you will find people that agree with you. But then if you subscribe to a right-leaning philosophy, you'll probably find those people too. So, yeah, I mean, okay. Yeah. So you're wondering if it's...
Have you been to Minneapolis?
I have not.
Okay. I was going to ask if you think it's similar, because I was there for a while.
I would like to go. Impression. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's Midwestern, so I feel like maybe the red versus blue, you might feel the red maybe a little bit more strongly because it's the Midwest, but...
In Minneapolis?
Yeah.
No, Minneapolis is actually very progressive. And Minnesota and Wisconsin have like a very progressive history.
It's okay.
Like worker co-ops and...
Gotcha.
And that sort of stuff. In fact, I think there were 7 food co-ops in Minneapolis and St. Paul.
That's not bad.
We have one here.
Yeah.
Well, 2 locations.
Right.
But yeah, it's so I found that to be a nice place. But yeah, the suburbs are suburbs.
Yeah. So maybe the question is Portland a Shangri-La?
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of, in a way. I think I might be slightly jaded against any of the good aspects because I've been there for so long. That what it takes to impress me as something that's a good thing is significantly more than it would take maybe for a lot of people. The bicycling infrastructure, and if you follow Bike Portland, this is something they talk about a lot. The bicycling infrastructure is not nearly as progressive as maybe a cultural permeation of bicycling is okay. So there's a lot of people that have bikes, ride bikes, love bikes. There's not as much paint or concrete on the ground to support that.
So it's okay. So it's sort of like it's farther along than a lot of places, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. Is what you're saying?
Right, right. Yeah. It's not. It's not like a promised land of no strife and no problems. That's for sure.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It's. I mean, that being said, it's a great place to ride a bike, and I mean, I've lived there partially out of convenience because I grew up near there, and I moved there in my. I think I was 18 years old, so I spent my 20s in Portland. And I loved it. And so I've got a lot of cultural connection to it. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's also, I think it's a pretty good place to live.
Yeah, so. It's kind of how I feel about here. It's like, yeah, I have my connections here. And that's kind of one of the reasons I came back. But also, yeah, it's like, yeah, I do like it here. And it is good. And
yeah,
there's a lot of nice things about Boston area. Still sucks to find a place to live. It's like, how's the housing situation in Portland?
The housing situation in Portland is crazy, man. Rents have gone far up. Okay. And that's another thing I think you might or might not realize it as a new transplant, as someone who came from somewhere else. But anyone who's grown up or spent time in the Portland area notices that the places that used to be cool, as in just like the place, not like, you know, culturally cool maybe, but just like the neighborhoods that were fun to hang out in that had kind of a DIY spirit of do-it-yourself. The punk ethos is pretty heavy in a lot of Portland cultural spots. And all of the places I think that were most traditionally Portland in that way have been developed up. So rent is high. The cost of going out and drinking and eating is higher. The cultural import is still there for the people who remember it, and some of the holdout businesses still hang out there. But more and more, that sort of stuff is being pushed to the fringes, as it often is.
Yeah.
And it's like the third wave of development, right? Because downtown cities started that way because that's where people went to do business. And then there was a lot of flight to suburbs, and so all that business moved outward. And then the third wave of things being redeveloped in the city center means that people are taking steps back into that area to build new housing, which increases cost of living and that sort of thing. So
I noticed most cities haven't really dealt with this, but there have been a couple like New York that have really been sort of pushing that. The idea that we're getting so many more people moving in, and it's like New York, they said they're going to have another 1 million people in the next 15 years.
That's incredible.
I know for us, it's probably not going to be 1 million, but it's going to be, you know, a similar percentage of our population.
Right.
And so it's going to be a lot more people moving into Boston. There already are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, housing prices are just absolutely insane. We don't have anywhere near enough housing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a lot of times what happens is that people get, you know, now people are moving. People with more money, like, you know, middle class people are moving to places where there isn't rapid transit, and that's like the areas that have been traditionally cheaper. And so it's sort of like, I don't even know like where people are going.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I sort of want to find the people who are, you know, who are the recent immigrants living in the rooming houses and, you know, working at like crappy jobs at the airport and stuff. And like, I kind of want to know where these people are going.
Where is this place? Because I'd like to move there. Yeah.
Yeah. And like maybe move there, maybe leave it to them. But like, I'm just curious. Like, I don't understand. I don't see where all the places that were traditionally like immigrant heavy. And like, it's just like now they're all like, you know, white people working in middle class jobs.
Sure. Yeah.
Like,
think that's the case in a lot of places. Like the traditional, it's like the working class and the artist class and that sort of thing. The places where rents were cheap become cool, and then the rents go up. And so then you have to, the artists and working class have to carve out a new place to live. So, yeah. But all that being said, I think, like I say, Portland is still a good place to be. So, you know, visit if it ever becomes practical for you.
I definitely want to visit.
Yeah. Matter of fact, we have a guest room, which I may have offered like 2 or 3 years ago. And if, you know, if you come through, it's still at your disposal.
I'm still looking forward to the transit tour.
Excellent. Oh, that's right. Yeah, because you helped us with the fundraising and whatnot.
I did.
All right. So, well, we'll get you a day pass. We'll go everywhere.
Nice, nice. Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, man.
It's been great.
Yeah. I was just thinking, you talked to that Adam Fisher guy that did the tube challenge.
Yes, I did. That was a while ago. Yeah.
And I talked to him too. I remember I was thinking that it would be fun to do some sort of like tube challenge ish thing in Portland.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I mean, I know people have done it in the Boston T rapid transit system, but I was wondering if like there's other things that you could do. Yeah, like if you're using pieces of the bus network or like you could put something together.
It was, right.
Or maybe you just vary it up a little bit, because I'm not so much interested in doing it as fast as possible just to do it. I sort of want to see stuff, and so I wonder if you could vary it up and put like certain challenges in there.
Totally. Yeah. Before my favorite transit publication kind of got absorbed into Bike Portland, it was Portland Afoot, and they had a big citywide game thing where they had a bunch of people use the transit system to basically do a scavenger hunt.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And it was kind of a photo-based thing where you'd tweet photos, hashtag them, put them up. It was pretty awesome. It took a while. I think it took like 5 hours, I want to say, of kind of on the street, either riding or waiting for buses and Macs. But it's one of those things where, if you have a fun thing to do that involves transit, it's great. And if you know a lot about the system, you know, you're well-advantaged to win.
Yeah. If you haven't done an alley cat race for biking,
only once or twice.
Do that. That's fun.
Yeah, too. Yeah. I feel like I would like to do some more of that.
I did it in Minneapolis. It was a lot of fun. It was an alley cat race. I can't remember what it was called, but it was basically like specifically designed for like non super amazing fast bikers.
Oh yeah, it was like a beginner's alley cat.
I'm sorry.
Beginner's alley cat.
Yes. It was a lot of fun because you weren't like. You could go at your own pace, and you didn't have to go. So there were a lot of people there, and we would just find other people that we would ride with, and you know, you didn't have to. It wasn't like a race. I mean, some people did race, but it wasn't intended to be a race.
Yeah, those are fun.
Yeah.
So trying to remember.
How'd you get over here? Did you take?
I took the T. Yeah, and actually, did you know that? Well, I'm sure you did. That Charlie cards expire.
Yes, there's been a lot of announcements about that, yes.
Yeah, audible announcements on the bus, which I heard like one yesterday, one today.
It reminds me of how people complain about the announcements when they announce the stops.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, you know, that is useful to some people. And in fact, many people, when it's like dark or whatever, you know, I don't know where you're going, you can't see. But, you know, there's... people complain about that, and I'm sort of like, okay, well, I feel like I'm complaining about this. And there's also an announcement that is less common now, but it's if you have a concern or a complaint about the cleanliness of this bus, and they, you know, they give you an email address on the announcement. And so I emailed it the other day, and I got a reply like right away. No, it actually was a reply from like a real person who's superintendent of whatever bus garage.
Nice.
And
like, oh, hey, there's gum on the floor or something like
no,
that?
No, I just emailed it and I said I think buses are generally in excellent condition and you did a great job. And like, you know, I don't know if anybody complained about this, but like, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, I take the bus everywhere or whatever. And so you wrote back, oh, you know, like, you know, we appreciate that. Like, we try hard and stuff.
Yeah. You know, so. Oh, that's cool.
But I was like, yeah, you know, it's nice to send, it's always nice to send positive feedback. And especially when you, you know, something like that is like, I know that the reason for that announcement was because somebody or some people complain persistently about the cleanliness of buses.
And right.
So, oh, you know, people just don't know how they can contact you, and they would. And so somebody, so they put up an email. And it's like, all right, well, let's send an email and say, you know. And I didn't say you should get rid of the announcement because I didn't want to sound like a negative person.
Right.
But yeah, they are very responsive to customer service, and it's mostly like, I feel like this is good and bad. It's a lot of what ails big agencies, big government agencies is, you know, they they were just geared to respond to people. So, you know, they often will take everybody's feedback and don't get so tired of hearing from certain people that, okay, we'll do it. And, you know, they often do things that aren't the best.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's like an example of our Toronto trolley line, the B line, the green line. It's the slowest. It's super slow. It's like, it's slower than walking a lot of times. And no exaggeration there. And so, you know, when they had a pilot program a bunch of years ago to remove some of the stops, which are literally like a block apart, and, you know, every old woman comes out and, you know, so, oh, you know, what am I going to do? I can't, you know. And then they said, okay, yeah, well, you know, we'll leave it. You know, you wind up with a lot of stuff like that. And it's like, but, you know, on the other hand, it's like the TS made great strides in recent years to be responsive to people. You know, in a lot of their issues are more than just taking customer feedback. They, you know, a lot of their issues are, you know, underinvestment and, you know, these deep-seated history of, you know, sort of just underfunding and, you know, the transit agency and just not having the resources to give attention to things like, you know, like the fare policy and the coordinated connections and other things that, like, we really could make a lot of progress on, even without a lot of additional resources. But they, you know, they're busy putting out the fires. So,
yeah,
you know, I mean, they do an excellent job running what they have. And, you know, I don't want to sound negative. but I want to help you.
Right, right. And it's a good system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it runs, you know, just getting the buses out and back and the trains out and back at the end of the day is kind of a feat in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about that, man. It's like, how many people must work for the T? It's got to be, you know, like thousands of people, right?
It was, when I started working at the T in 2006, it was about, as an intern, it was about 6,500 people.
That's incredible.
And it has gone down. I don't know exactly what it's at now, but I want to say it's gone down. It's definitely under 6,000.
So people are working harder than they used to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's very, very difficult. And, you know, even though the population grows and transit ridership is up, there hasn't been any substantial increase in service in decades.
Yeah. Just kind of towing the line.
Yeah. And there's, you know, now that there's Twitter, there's a lot of people, you know, if you follow the MBTA hashtag, there's a lot of people tweeting in the T and
hashtag snakes on a bus.
You know, yeah. And then one of the things that I'm trying to do with this new group that we're trying to get going, Transit Matters, is sort of, there's a lot of people that are frustrated with various things about the T, which maybe they should be frustrated with, but they're often, the anger is channeled in unproductive, hostile ways.
Gotcha.
So people will tweet like, oh, I hate the MBTA. The MBTA sucks. You know, you guys don't know what the hell you're doing. And that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know, yeah, I mean, bus bunching sucks, but, you know, there's concrete ways of dealing with this and
how to
channel that.
Yeah.
You know, because I know, yeah, it is frustrating. And yeah, you know, if you get stuck in that situation, you want to, you know, it is frustrating that the T doesn't have the resources / possibly the desire to address bus bunching and really long gaps in service. So that's frustrating, but at the same time, it's like, you know, there's ways that we can possibly deal with this.
Yeah.
And, you know, how can we do that?
Right, right.
So that's what we're kind of working with now. We're trying to see if we can, you know, do we start like a traditional advocacy group, or do we, you know, what do we do here, and how can we best move this process forward?
Would that be weird if you were hanging out with like an advocacy group where you had worked on the, like, I guess the organizational side of transit here, and then like you end up being like a lobbyist or something?
Yeah, it might be a little weird, but I think it's pretty common.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's in a different way than, it's not like, you know, when you're, you know, in Congress and you're sort of,
right,
you know, giving big oil contracts and then you get a job working for big oil. It's like,
right, right.
You know.
Well, you're not working against transit. You just have like ideas you want to advocate for.
And we're not like, it's not like the T is an interest group that, you know, like a lot of people think, oh, I pay all this money to the T, and, you know, the T is not like a, you know, a corporation. The T is a public service that, you know, it spends more money than it gets from customers, right? So it's not a business.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and it's a public service. And so we're not just, you know, I'm advocating for something that I believe in because of the meaningful impact on our lives and, you know, in our societies. And so it's not like we're just trying to support this one entity.
Totally. Yeah. And it seems like, I don't know, advocacy can go so many different ways, because there are people who are like, you know, even in Portland, there are groups whose major message is just like, everything's terrible, you know, we must point out the flaws. And then there are other people who are kind of coming at it from a what seems like a more reasonable perspective. Like, we understand that change is hard, and you know, here are some small concrete steps. So
yeah, and I went to an interesting talk last week that sort of it was a program. There were 10 talks, and everybody got 10 minutes. It was a Livable Streets Alliance sponsored event.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of people were talking about, you know, various livable streets stuff, you know, bikes and transit, whatever. And one of the speakers sort of hit on this, where he was in Dallas. He co-founded this group called Better Block, and it's kind of like a loose network of groups all around the country. And they got frustrated in this part of Dallas where, you know, it was like you think of your typical old, like, declining city where you got this, you know, these three lane one way streets and no parking and just no businesses there and everything's just like nobody's there, you know.
Right, right.
And they just sort of wanted to show people, you know, what it could be. And they got frustrated working within the current channels, within, like, you know, advocating politicians and stuff. And they said, you know what, let's just go down there. Let's just put up some cones. Let's just get some paint. Let's just get a bunch of people out here to just, like, do some stuff. We can, you know, put some planters down and we can, you know, sort of show people. And it really catalyzed the sort of not just the acceptance, but the passion in people's desire to see more of that. And it sort of accelerated, you know, and then the city sort of started sponsoring stuff like that. And,
So was this first action, was that like activism, like against, like they were just like, we're going to do this kind of guerrilla style?
Right, exactly. It was like total DIY, you know, what they call tactical urbanism. It was like, we're going to put it on the street. We're tired of, you know, being able to run around. But like, what something typically takes in the public sector, you know, the years that it takes for public involvement, and, you know, you gotta address all the stakeholders, and you gotta do the studies and the environmental analysis, and, you know, you have to do an environmental impact report even for something that has a net positive on the environment.
Yeah,
transit, which we just know,
right?
It's just a fact.
Unless you listen to Freakonomics.
Yeah, of course. Bastards. I did an episode on that, I think, or I covered that in a Critical Transit episode a while ago.
Oh yeah, response to
about how that's, you know, the idea of well, they did a couple things. There was the empty buses critique, and then there was. It was the environmental. I think they did one on the environmental impacts of transit, and you know, all that stuff is just like just almost complete bullshit.
Right. Right.
So I covered
picked that. Up and run with.
Yeah, and the empty buses is a particular favorite of mine.
Yeah,
comes out. Small transit agencies have to deal with this a lot more because they get, you know, that people see them and they see these buses that may not have that many people on at a particular time. But they don't realize that it's like it's part of a route.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just turning around. Maybe it's going to the route or whatever, you know.
I was in Eugene, Oregon, and I remember there was some sign lobbying against their new rapid transit bus option. And it said something like, count the number of people on the next bus that you see. Yeah.
Jeez.
It's tricky. Are you more a fan of... I feel like it's a false dichotomy to say, like, you know, either or, like activism or advocacy. But like, would you say are you more a fan of trying to work within the rules, or are you more a fan of let's do what we can and, you know, let the system deal with it?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I mean, it's I've been working within the system for quite a while.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of starting to, and I knew that there were ways of working outside the system. What I'm trying to work out right now, and a bunch of people that I'm working with on transit, is how can we use these things to get better transit service? So on the one hand, you have access to transit, which is walking.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's 100% of transit users are pedestrians. So, you know, when we talk about walking, we're like, nobody walks around here or you know, whatever. You have these stupid pedestrian push buttons, all these other issues. And they go, oh, well, most of the people are cars. I said, well, no, people walk. They access transit. But so there's that. There's making the environment more pleasant. There's making the, you know, just the basic fixes that, you know, when you, in a lot of these places, when you have to cross the street, everybody's got to cross the street with transit because, you know, inevitably you're at least going to, you have to cross the street at least once. To get, you know, the return trip or whatever. So you have to deal with crossings, with, you know, good sidewalks. You know, a lot of times there's just like very basic stuff that needs to be fixed. And you know, you're talking these suburban communities. A lot of these suburban communities with transit, they don't even have any sidewalks.
Right.
You know, we at least have sidewalks, but here now we're getting into winter, right? I mean, half the times the sidewalks don't get clear, and the city goes, oh, the business owner's responsibility to shovel, and they, you know, they put up a big stink, and but nothing ever happens. And so it's sort of, you sort of wonder, like, are there things we can do, you know, to improve access to transit and also beyond access to transit? You know, we want faster bus service. We want people to see what it would be like if the buses didn't have to sit in this miserable rush hour gridlock.
Yeah.
And, you know, what that would look like, and all hell won't break loose for the businesses.
It's the John Lennons of the transit camp.
Yeah, yeah. We want people to see that. We want people to you know, imagine what it's like. And how do we do that in a way that doesn't, because when you go through this public process, it often doesn't go anywhere. Or if it does, it gets watered down, or it's in 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the planet is in an emergency right now. Mm-hmm. And the city is in an emergency. We don't have, there's not enough places people to live that people can afford. The transit is inadequate for our current needs. You know, the planet is heating up. We're going to kill ourselves soon. Like, we don't have 15 years to get a little, you know, a little bit of a bus lane.
So activism is somewhat necessary.
Right. Like, we need fast transit now. Like, you know,
there's only so much activism you can do in transit matters, because you can't operate your own transit service.
Right. So that's what we're trying to work out.
We're kind of bound to advocacy.
Yeah.
But
and we're kind of stuck there, because we're trying to figure out, you know, what can we do? Mm-hmm. You know, could I, like, if I, like, say I put up a bunch of cones and, like, I made my own bus lane and I just, like, stood there at the entrance. Like, waiting for the bus to come.
Right.
The bus driver probably couldn't use that.
What the hell are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, like, they're probably not, so...
You've just created a zone where I am...
Right.
I have to make unsafe maneuvers or whatever. Like, yeah. So well-intentioned activism. Yeah. That's the thing, is that, like, all activism is well-intentioned, right? Unless you're a terrorist. But
or racist.
Depends on who you're talking to about whether or not that's the case. Yeah. Yeah. But then there are tons of things you can do. Like, in Portland, there was just a thing where people have been concerned about this bikeway that because of construction on the main thoroughfare, on the arterial, private car traffic was being diverted. I think it started out being officially diverted to Clinton Street. And then just as construction and things have gone on, like, people have gotten used to that. And so now there's more car traffic on this supposed bike lane or bike street. And there was this activist group that they rolled out, like, some half-keg planters with little trees in them and that sort of thing. They dropped them right in the middle of an intersection. It was a classic kind of diagonal diverter idea. Mm-hmm. And it lasted, I think, 2 or 3 hours in the morning, like, after the sun came up and people started doing the regular commutes. The city came and pulled them out, you know, and kind of restored things. But it was a classic example of, like, here's a thing. We're going to try doing it and just see what happens.
Yeah. Because you need sort of, like, you need it to sort of get beyond that initial period of, like you need something temporary so, like, nobody freaks out.
Right.
But you also need something that's, like, goes beyond that initial, like, when they freak out.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, holy shit, what the hell do I do here? And then after that, first time they figure it out. Oh, okay, this is fine. And everything just goes back to normal and it's fine and it's safer.
Yeah.
And it's good. But you also need, the third element is you need the public feedback. You need the public support. You need to figure out ways to get people to you know, say, like, do you like this? And, like, call the mayor and tell the mayor that you want more of this.
Exactly.
And then, that's how it sort of starts to go in motion.
There we go. So that's the most important sign for any activist to build.
Yes.
Is here.
Tell the mayor.
We did a thing guerrilla style.
Yeah.
If you like it, yeah, here's the person to talk to.
That's the thing. Yeah, you have to reach out to people. You have to. And, like, that's why these bike lanes, when they put up the planters to demonstrate a cycle track,
uh-huh.
It's like, that's really meaningful.
In
Minneapolis, they did a lot of that. That's really meaningful to people because it's, you know, they get to ride on it, and then you go stand at the end of it or in the middle and
there
say,
you go.
Oh, what did you think of that? Here, why don't you sign this postcard that we're going to send to
write
the city
your congressman.
Council.
Yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Have you seen, like, the guerrilla crosswalks? People paint down, like,
yes.
You know, temporary thing. That was happening in Tacoma, I remember. And I know it happens in a lot of places. But that's something I kind of like because, well, I don't know if it was chalk or paint. I mean, if it's paint, that means public dollars have to come out and clean it up.
Yeah, what it says is that it goes to that issue of... there was a presentation about this at a conference I went to a couple of years ago on what they called informal paths.
Yeah.
Of these places where people walk, like a desire line.
Right.
And, you know, if you're not so much of a city planning as, you know, we're dealing with cars. And if you look at so many of our intersections, even around here, you look at a place like Davis Square or mm-hmm. something, you know, where Union Square is like, you know, it's pretty bad. And you see where you can't, where the way the crossings are designed, even just like where the crosswalks are. But then especially when it comes down to the signals, where you got to push the button. Well, then you only get the signal go halfway. Now you're standing in the median. You got
to
wait
8 minutes to get around the square.
Yeah. And it doesn't, Davis Square is the worst because it's the signal is... The signal cycle only comes every 3 minutes. The walk signal only comes every 3 minutes. It lasts for 20 seconds before it flashes for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you can't possibly get all the way across. Like, if you were legally trying to do it, you can't get all the way across. It would take you 6 minutes.
Yeah.
At least.
And public behavior shows that
right.
people won't stand for that.
Right. So it's partly that. And then the other thing is, like, when you... If you're just painting a crosswalk, it's like, I don't know if that... Does that... How does that work? Does that...
Right.
Does it work well enough to sort of make it better for people, or is it just like one of those things? Like, sometimes the highway engineers, they'll paint the crosswalk somewhere, but it's like a 4-lane highway, and you're like, I'm not gonna.
I don't feel comfortable doing this. Yeah. The desire line thing is interesting because even Google Maps, I feel like people, if I'm not mistaken, people can submit their own things, their own workarounds, where it's not technically a path, but like if enough people walk or bike through there, like Google will make the connection. So that people can follow those directions the next time they're trying to get somewhere.
That's pretty cool. You mean like through like a, I don't know, like a courtyard or something like
that? Yeah, like I used to live right next to one, the multi-use path where the old lady got hit. I used to live on that path. And there was no technical, like there wasn't certainly not ADA access. But, you know, I think we started using this desire line because the path was right there. So we'd pop out over some dirt and rocks and that sort of thing. Eventually we built a ramp that I think the city cleared away. But it was just kind of this is such an easy connection to make. And I think at that point my friend was like, oh, hey, you can tell Google Maps this is a real thing. And he did. So now it's there.
That's cool. Yeah. Because it's a lot of it's information, especially in a place like this where, you know, we don't have this nice grid system of streets. And so, you know, a lot of times you need to, you know, finding good walking routes and especially biking routes, you know, just knowing that there are certain places that you can go that you might not realize.
Yeah.
It'll save you a lot of time and stress.
Totally.
And terror, I suppose, getting back to that.
Yeah. And if you know it's there, like that will save you. Yeah. All of those things. Yeah. It's a great thing.
So, do it yourself. Get out there, build stuff. And
DIY.
DIY.
Yeah.